The next person I met with was Dr. Howard Hoekster, who began our conversation by commenting on one of his major clinical research interests, oxaliplatin neurotoxicity and its potential amelioration with calcium and magnesium.
The issue with oxaliplatin neurotoxicity is that it is a cumulative dose-limiting toxicity, so that basically you have a drug that works really well for colon cancer, but you cannot give enough of it to achieve the maximum benefit. If we go back to the N9741 study, the one that Rich Goldberg conducted that compared FOLFOX to IFL, they could show that most patients with FOLFOX went off treatment before progression. And in fact, the time to treatment failure for FOLFOX is about 6 months, and the time to progression was about 9 months. So that really you stopped oxaliplatin on the average well before people progressed. So in that context, if you add a biologic that might be anticipated to increase the time to progression from 9 months to, let's say, 11 or 12 months, you're still going to run into the same problem of early time to treatment failure. You're not going to be able to get the optimal use of oxaliplatin. So one way that we've been able to deal with that is the use of calcium and magnesium. So this story really begins with a neurophysiologist in France who was married to an oncologist. And he was telling her about the oxaliplatin neurotoxicity. This is Eric Gamelan. And she said, oh, well, that's just like myotonia. You get opening of the sodium channels and the nerves get hyperexcitable. And in fact, they tested it out, and it seemed like that's what was happening, that somehow the oxalate portion of oxaliplatin stripped away calcium and opened these sodium channels, depolarizing the neurons and causing them to be hyperreactive. And, you know, we see that clinically in practice. All the time patients tell me they start chewing, they take a bite, and then they get this incredible trigeminal pain. And it's really, you start the neurologic reflex and then the nerve kind of is overstimulated and it just continues to fire in a way that causes a lot of pain. So they showed in their model system that if you gave calcium and magnesium back at the time of oxaliplatin, it would be helpful. And a clinical trial where they gave a gram of calcium and a gram of magnesium before and after oxaliplatin to some patients and some who didn't get it showed that patients who got the calcium magnesium had a much lower rate of going off oxaliplatin for neurotoxicity. And the response rates were pretty similar. But this was not a randomized trial. So in the concept trial, one of our goals was to really do the first randomized placebo-controlled study of calcium magnesium in prevention of oxaliplatin neurotoxicity. And the second thing was, how can we improve the time to treatment failure? So we already knew that there was a whole schedule issue with oxaliplatin from Amory de Gramont's work in the Optimox study. So in the Optimox study, he said, well, what we'll do is we'll just give a high dose of oxaliplatin for 6 cycles, and then we'll stop the oxaliplatin and give it back when patients start to progress again. And in that study, the Optimox 1 study from his cooperative group in France, they showed that, in fact, the response rate and the time to progression was the same either way, and there was much less neurotoxicity with the interrupted, the Optimox approach. However, most of the patients in that study did not get oxaliplatin again. They kind of didn't understand it, or the doctors forgot by the time it came around to progressing. They just switched regimens, whatever. So, in fact, most patients did not get reintroduced, and Dr. de Gramont always says the study would be much better if people had gotten oxaliplatin again. So what we did in the concept study was to say, okay, we're going to use the conventional dose of oxaliplatin, but we'll give it in 4-month blocks. And especially when we add bevacizumab, we expect that patients will not progress in the intermediate 4 months where they are not getting oxaliplatin. And in fact, nobody did. In our study, nobody did.
And was the 5-FU continued?
Yes, 5-FU and bevacizumab was continued. We just stopped the oxaliplatin for 4 months. So you got 4 months of FOLFOX with bevacizumab and then 4 months of 5-FU with bevacizumab, and then you automatically restarted the oxaliplatin again at the 8th month. So we originally were going to have 570 patients in a 2-by-2 trial, and turned out the accrual was kind of slow, and most doctors really did not think we should give a randomized study of calcium magnesium because they all knew it worked, and we were accruing slowly. So we amended the protocol after 120 patients and said everybody would get calcium magnesium, and then there would be only one randomization to the intermittent or the continuous oxaliplatin. And what happened after 20 more patients were enrolled, so we got up to 140 patients then, the Independent Data Monitoring Committee took a look at the data, and they got reports from the CRO that was managing the study of a lot of patients who had gotten unconfirmed responses, and they also had a lot of patients who had recently started calcium magnesium, so it looked as though there were fewer responses in the group that got calcium magnesium. I think it was more of a study analysis bias that showed that. So at that point, the IDMC said, stop the trial. Nobody can get calcium magnesium. It may interfere with response because it looks as though the response rate is lower for people who are getting calcium magnesium with FOLFOX bevacizumab. So the study was stopped and lots of other studies were stopped. And the NCI sent out a letter and we published the letter in JCO to tell everybody this is a potential problem. In the meantime, we got all the scans together and gave them to an independent radiology review committee, which independently, unblinded to treatment assignment and everything, went through and scored every scan as a response or not. And as we presented at the ASCO GI meeting last January, the response rate was actually equivalent or slightly better with calcium magnesium. The hazard ratio was 1.3, so, you know, there was really no effect of calcium magnesium on response. And then, furthermore, at ASCO this year, we showed that the time progression was much better. The hazard ratio was 0.6 with the intermittent schedule. So that, in fact, the time to treatment failure, which was the primary endpoint, instead of being about 4 months with continuous oxaliplatin, was over 6 months for the group that got the intermittent. And in terms of time to progression, it was even longer. The difference was 7 months versus 12 months. So with a very truncated study of only 140 patients, the effect was large enough that we could see a real effect on time to treatment failure and time to progression. So this was, I think, a very important study teaching us how to better use oxaliplatin to get the most benefit out of it.
So just to pick apart the two key points there, in terms of the issue of the possibility of the calcium magnesium affecting the anti-tumor effect, in retrospect, do you think there was maybe some other way to approach the data monitoring in this or the way this was approached that would have avoided? It wasn't just that the trial was stopped. It was like everybody immediately got concerned about using calcium magnesium for a while. Do you think that looking back, there could have been something done to prevent that?
Well, we're going to do more of an analysis of that, and I think we'll have some more information on that coming out in the next couple months. We're going to really do a very complete analysis of what was available initially versus what the radiology review committee. I mean, I think that a more sophisticated analysis of exactly when people went on study and who had gotten enough assessments to be evaluable or not may have helped, but it may not have helped. I really can't say at this time. I think that there was a signal that there was something negative going on, and without making a lot of assumptions about how the data were analyzed and going into a lot of contortions, which a data monitoring committee can't really do, it just, you know, looked of concern. So I hope we'll be able to come to a more substantial conclusion and perhaps report back to people what the real problem was and how we might avoid this in the future. I think that's the goal of everybody who was involved.
What other data sets are out there looking at calcium and magnesium, and kind of how do you put everything together right now in terms of what its potential impact is?
So there's one other really good study about this, and at the same time, the North Central Group was doing a neurotoxicity prevention study in adjuvant therapy. So these were stage 2 and 3 colon cancer patients who are getting FOLFOX and they were randomized to calcium magnesium the same way we were giving it or placebo. And that study was also stopped early, unfortunately, but with about 50 patients in each arm, they reported again at ASCO this year that the incidence of grade 2 and 3 neurotoxicity by any of three scales, the NCI scale or an oxaliplatin specific scale or another neurotoxicity scale, was about half when you gave calcium magnesium. And this was statistically significant in all the ways they looked at it. So in that particular study, we don't have any response data because it was all adjuvant. And, you know, we may know in a couple of years if there's any difference in relapse rate when you give calcium magnesium in the adjuvant setting, but I think that's highly unlikely. But at the moment, that study also showed that you get much less grade 2 and 3 neurotoxicity with the use of calcium magnesium.
So what's your bottom line right now in terms of the use of calcium magnesium in a non-protocol situation? How do you think it should be utilized?
Well, I think the data are quite clear that it does not interfere with activity, so that should not be an issue. And I think it's also quite clear that it does lower cumulative and acute neurotoxicity. So I think it's very safe to use that, and I do not think that people who found it helpful before should be concerned about readopting it as a standard of care.
So do you use this preventively in your practice?
I do. I went back to using it all the time. I stopped for about 8-10 months while we were looking at the data.
And this is just routine in every patient or in general or adjuvant, metastatic?
Well, I think for metastatic, we've got the response data. If somebody really wants to be very, very much of a stickler, you can say that we really don't know if there's some effect in the adjuvant setting. So that would be perhaps a little bit more risky to give it in the adjuvant setting. But I really do not see how that's a real possibility. I mean, it would be prudent perhaps in that, if you were concerned about that, to wait till people start to get more neurotoxicity, or if they have symptoms of acute neurotoxicity that are bothersome, then give it. Once you see that, it's more of a need than just to give it to everybody.
What about the issue of the type of neurotoxicity, the acute cold intolerance versus the longer-term peripheral neuropathy in calcium and magnesium?
I think that in the general experience that, you know, all of us see and we're can see much more easily with our own talking to patients, and the nurses are really convinced it's based on the acute neurotoxicity. I mean, people get much less of the cold-induced neurotoxicity, and this kind of trigeminal pain that many people report on is much less when you give calcium magnesium. But also from the North Central Group study, really looks like it decreases the cumulative neurotoxicity also. We didn't see that so much in the CONCEPT study, but one of the problems is that we truncated the study. I mean, 140 people were entered, but then everybody went off as soon as the DMC said close the study. So we really didn't have, a lot of them didn't have long enough follow-up for us to be able to make a judgment on the cumulative neurotoxicity.
Is there the opportunity, or does it make any sense to consider using oral magnesium or calcium?
Not really from the way the physiology works. I mean, it's got to be kind of a high dose that's going to get to the neurons. At the moment, the oxaliplatinum is taking away the calcium. So it's not like a chronic injury where giving back some calcium and magnesium slowly with oral absorption would make a difference, I don't think.
And how effective is calcium magnesium in ameliorating neuropathy that's already present as opposed to preventing it?
I would think very little or none.
So it's not effective?
I don't think so.
What about the other issue that was looked at in the CONCEPT trial in terms of the, you know, sort of treatment holiday or the oxaliplatin holiday? How does that translate into clinical management in your own practice? What's the usual routine? You know, let's say you have a patient who's never had any chemotherapy, either presents with metastatic disease or recurrence without adjuvant therapy, just to sort of make it clean. How do you think through the way you're going to approach these people and how you're going to integrate holidays?
That's a really good question. And, you know, mostly we've been treating people on protocols as much as possible, so I have a little bit less opportunity to kind of do this ad hoc. But now that we have the KRAS stratification, there are more people who aren't going on studies because they're not eligible. So I have run into this a little bit more, and I think it is important to get the maximum benefit of the oxaliplatin to take a break for a while and then come back to use it again. So again, in the concept trial, we did 4 months on, 4 months off, 4 months on again, and patients really got out to 12 months before the median time to progression, which is kind of like what we said would happen when we had bevacizumab. We need to get out to 12 months time to progression. So that was somewhat gratifying, and I think it is a way to get more benefit from the oxaliplatin. I think the opposite side of the coin is what we saw in the very large Roche 966 trial that had 1,400 patients randomized to CAPOX or FOLFOX with or without bevacizumab. And in that study, everybody stopped all the chemo at 6 months, and there was very minimum amount of benefit from the addition of bevacizumab. I mean, it was still statistically significant, but the hazard ratio was like 0.83 instead of 0.65, which we would kind of expected for PFS. So if you stop at 6 months, or if everybody gets neurotoxicity by 6 months, then there's no way that you're going to benefit from a drug that improves the progression-free survival.
Where are we right now in terms of adjuvant trials in colorectal cancer, and how have these trials been affected by the new KRAS data that's come out?
Well, I think that if you turn back the clock a year or two, we were all thinking FOLFOX is great, combination chemo with bevacizumab is greater, and you know, if you add cetuximab also, as we saw in the BOND-2 trial, that seems to be even better. So we just need to add everything on. We need to pile on the drugs, so to speak. You know, we would give FOLFOX with Bev or FOLFOX with Bev and cetuximab, and that was the study of the current intergroup trial, 80405. And I think we would have done the same thing in adjuvant therapy also. That was kind of the direction we were talking about for planning the next generation of adjuvant trials. I mean, the current state of affairs is that we know FOLFOX is better than 5-FU, and NSABP has now completed the trial of FOLFOX plus bevacizumab versus FOLFOX. We saw the toxicity data at ASCO this year presented by Mike O'Connell, and it showed it was safe to give the bevacizumab for the 6 months with the chemo and an additional 6 months. And hopefully by next year, if there are enough events, we'll see the actual efficacy data. But at the moment, we're still waiting to see events in that COA trial. There's also another European trial, partial U.S., called the AVANT trial. And that, too, is waiting for events till we see if the adjuvant bevacizumab is helpful. So, you know, if in the advanced disease setting, chemo plus Bev plus cetuximab had been promising, we would probably already be moving in that direction for adjuvant therapy. But unfortunately, we saw the PACE trial, which showed a negative effect by adding cetuximab. And also the CAIRO trial at ASCO this year that showed pretty much the same thing. So this is not a useful strategy. So that has, I think, caused us to rethink what we need to do in the adjuvant setting. And in Europe, there's some studies of looking at less oxaliplatin, like the TOSCA trial in Italy is looking at 12 cycles versus 6 cycles of FOLFOX in the adjuvant setting.
What's your take on why the combination strategy hasn't been playing out, as in the CAIRO and PACE trials?
There's a lot about biology we don't know, I think, is the answer. I mean, some of it is the KRAS data. There may be some kind of negative interaction when, for KRAS mutated patients, if you give them an anti-EGF drug. That looked like that was the case in the CAIRO trial, and in the PACE trial, we don't really have the data yet, but that could also be the case. So, you know, manipulating the different pathways may have an adverse effect at times. The other thing may be just that there's more toxicity. You know, in the advanced disease setting for the intergroup trial that we're all participating in, the 80405 trial, I mean, there are no safety concerns yet, and the data monitoring committee is watching that very closely. So it's still a valid question, but I think we need to really straighten out who's going to benefit for it. And in fact, it may turn out that if you have wild-type KRAS, that this may be a great strategy, and maybe in the adjuvant setting may be a great strategy too.
Although I guess in Cairo and PACE, that didn't seem to be the case in terms of patients with KRAS wild. Is that your take?
Well, in the Cairo trial, we know that the wild-type patients did not seem to benefit, but that was with capecitabine, not with FOLFOX. I don't know. I mean, yes, that was not too promising in that direction, but I think it's still a bit of an open question.
What are some of the ideas out there right now that you think would be maybe worth considering for the next generation of adjuvant trials?
Well, I think in the meantime, till we have another biologic to add to bevacizumab, assuming bevacizumab is going to be a step forward, I mean, we don't even know that yet, but assuming it is, then I think in the meantime, it'll be kind of go back to the same questions we were asking for the concept trial to a certain extent. Can we give the oxaliplatin in a more optimal way to decrease neurotoxicity, to maintain efficacy, to make the best benefit of the bevacizumab plus the oxaliplatin? It's hard to kind of come up with a strategy in the adjuvant setting for that.
You mentioned the safety data that was presented from the adjuvant NSABP BEV study, the CO8 trial at ASCO. What was your take on that?
I think that the nature of the toxicities were pretty much what one would have expected. There was a somewhat increase in the vascular side effects and the acute thrombotic episodes, but not really a lot. I mean, patients really tolerated it pretty well, maybe better than advanced disease. And even with a full year of the bevacizumab, there was a pretty low incidence of major thrombotic events or major vascular events. There wasn't any major postoperative issues with getting the bevacizumab. So, you know, it seemed like it was a very safe program.
What about TKIs in colorectal cancer? Obviously, they're used in a lot of other tumors, but at this point, I guess there's really nothing out there that's, you know, kind of part of standard care. Anything on the horizon there that you think may be helpful?
Funny you should use that word, but yes.
Horizon. Yeah.
Actually, you know, the first anti-angiogenesis oral TKI that was really in the big trials was fetalinib or PTK-787 in the confirmed trials, which came close but failed to show a benefit with the independent radiology review. And maybe the LDH marker was an indication of who might benefit more from this drug. But, you know, the thought is that the drug may induce its own metabolism or was the wrong schedule, or there could be reasons that that was not quite as effective as we've seen with the antibodies. On the other hand, turns out that Patrick Swayze is getting this drug in a pancreatic protocol, and he's doing very well, as reported in the New York Times recently. And he's filming a new TV series, so every one of my pancreatic patients is coming in and asking for this drug. And I try to tell them, well, it really didn't work in a large colon trial, so nobody's really using it anymore. But anyway.
I guess also with that, there was the issue whether they had this dosing schedule correct.
Right, and the dose, and maybe it induces its own metabolism so that, you know, you're getting less of an effect as you take it for weeks. So there are a few issues. But the drug that's really in the clinic now is AZ2171 or cedarinib. And this is another oral anti-VEGF receptor tyrosine kinase type drug that seems to have pretty good activity. And it is being studied now in two large trials, the Horizon 2 and the Horizon 3 trial. The Horizon 2 is mostly outside the U.S. of FOLFOX with cedarinib versus placebo. And in the U.S., they're doing a study of FOLFOX bevacizumab versus FOLFOX cedarinib. And I have a lot of respect for the company for actually doing that study of trying to compare their drug directly to bevacizumab, because most of the studies to date have kind of tried to sidestep that issue.
What's been seen in terms of side effects and toxicity with the agent?
It's pretty much the same as we've seen with the other anti-angiogenesis drugs. I don't think there's anything that's particularly unique to it.
Hypertension?
Right. Mostly hypertension is the main one. Some degree of then renal insufficiency, proteinuria, rare episodes of neurologic complications.
Any other agents sort of coming down the pike that you're excited about?
Well, there are a number of things. I mean, the pipelines that are out there today are really pretty staggering in terms of the number of targets and multiple drugs directed at each target. The hepatocyte growth factor, HGF, or MET, is one that's being studied in a lot of GI cancers and thyroid cancer. There's the insulin-like growth factor, IGF, which seems to be very interesting. Number of mTOR inhibitor drugs that are out there being combined today with anti-angiogenesis drugs. So those are just some of them. At the Chemotherapy Foundation, Mace Rothenberg was talking about a hedgehog inhibitor, 0449.
Yeah, what is that? I really like that name, but I mean, I'm not sure where they got it, but what is it?
Well, hedgehog signaling is a very early developmental pathway that's used to help organs develop and structures develop during embryogenesis. And when this pathway is activated, membranes become ruffled, and they have this kind of ruffled appearance that somebody said looks like a hedgehog.
Hmm.
So because of the hedgehog nomenclature, they found that the molecule that stimulates it, they named Sonic Hedgehog after the video game. So, you know, it's all very amusing that way. But Sonic Hedgehog binds to something called Patch. Patch inhibits smoothin, and smoothin is the thing that causes the membranes to be smoothed out instead of ruffled. So smoothin's on all the time, but if Patch blocks smoothin activity, then you get these ruffled membranes. And this may be important for cancer, and the proof of it is that basal cell carcinomas seem to be very dependent on this pathway. And in an early phase one study that Dan von Hoff was doing, he reported at AACR last year, like 4 or 5 out of 19 patients with refractory basal cell carcinomas responded to this. So this is an important pathway for at least a rare tumor, and hopefully maybe for some more common tumors. So a randomized phase 2 of this drug that actually blocks smoothin activity is ongoing, and we'll see if that somehow will potentiate the bevacizumab activity.
What's in the trial? What's it being compared with?
It's FOLFOX Bev versus FOLFOX Bev plus the hedgehog inhibitor.
What about side effects and toxicity?
It doesn't seem to have a lot of toxicity in the phase 1, phase 2 studies to date, so I don't think that it's been tested enough to have a really full profile.
What about rectal cancer? Anything new over the past year in that disease?
Well, you know, rectal cancer therapy tends to lag a little bit behind because we need to integrate the radiation also. So I think the big questions continue to be the use of oxaliplatin with radiation preoperatively and then kind of demonstrating that FOLFOX or FOLFOX plus Bev is going to be just as helpful postoperatively as in colon cancer. So there are the two trials, the NSABP pre-op trial, 5-FU versus CAPE, and with or without oxaliplatin, and then the post-op ECOG study, FOLFOX plus or minus Bev. I mean, there are some phase 2 trials going on now of integrating bevacizumab earlier based on the study that shows that bevacizumab itself may be a radiation potentiator and can really decrease the interstitial pressure and help regress rectal cancer. So
the last thing I want to ask you about is the issue of the patient with hepatic-only metastases. And I'm curious for your take on a couple issues there. The first is the patient who has potentially resectable disease, you know, maybe an isolated lesion, looks like it's going to be easy to take out. What are your thoughts about the, I guess it seems like a controversy emerging about whether or not these patients should get preoperative systemic therapy or not?
Well, I think it may be more of an apparent controversy than the real one. You know, most of us today, even if you have a solitary liver metastasis that's removed surgically, are going to land up giving some adjuvant therapy. So the real question is, should you give pre and post-op, or is post-op just as good? Now, I think that's really a question of style over substance. We know in the EORTC trial, they gave 3 months of FOLFOX before and 3 months of FOLFOX after liver resection for resectable liver metastases. And the effect was similar to the hazard ratio we see for adjuvant therapy with FOLFOX for colon cancer in general. So, you know, that shows that in a randomized study, that's very difficult to do, given surgical predilections, you can demonstrate the benefit of 6 months of FOLFOX. Whether you give half before or all 6 months afterwards, I think is kind of a non-issue. In my institution, if somebody has a solitary metastasis, we're probably likely to take them to the OR before. You know, if they've got more and we think we're going to downstage, we'll probably give pre-op and then go to surgery.
What about choice of therapy, both in the, quote, adjuvant setting after these lesions are removed, and also choice of therapy in the patient who needs tumor shrinkage in order to get to surgery?
Well, we don't have really great data that tells us if FOLFOX or FOLFIRI is a preferable chemotherapy in this setting, so I think either of them can be effective. The real question today might be the use of bevacizumab or cetuximab. So I guess we're thinking maybe the shrinkage rate with bevacizumab may not be as much as we like, mainly because in the large 966 study that I just mentioned, the response rate was the same in both arms. And so it didn't look like you got a large response rate difference when you add bevacizumab to FOLFOX. If you add bevacizumab to IFL, it looks like you get a 10% difference. When you add bevacizumab to FOLFOX in second-line therapy, it looks like you got a 10% difference. In the TREE trial, where we didn't have a randomization, but it was, you know, historical cohorts, it looked like there was a 10% difference. But the large randomized trial and the biggest trial ever done showed no difference. So that could be an issue. On the other hand, the first-line study of FOLFIRI with or without cetuximab, the CRYSTAL trial, if you have a KRAS wild type, you really benefited and you got a pretty good augmentation of response rate when you use cetuximab. So I think that's a real question if we should be using cetuximab as our first-line antibody if we're trying to really shrink down liver metastases preoperatively.
What about post-op?
Well, post-op, one would need to do another adjuvant trial and seeing how long it takes to recur and if there is any difference. So there may be something that's being planned. I don't know.
What's your approach right now in terms of selection of agents, or particularly whether you're going to use a biologic post-op?
I think that, in general, we've been using bevacizumab up to now. But, you know, with the first-line data coming out and the KRAS data, it is much more tempting in the wild-type patient to use cetuximab. And in Europe, FOLFIRI with cetuximab is an approved first-line regimen for wild-type patient population. In the U.S., whether the FDA is going to change the label is still a question because these are all retrospective data, but they're very convincing, and we know that the KRAS mutated patient does not really benefit from cetuximab or panitumumab. So, you know, if you have a wild-type KRAS, then your chance of responding to this kind of combination chemotherapy is 65 to 75%. You know, you want to maybe take advantage of that if you're trying to get people to surgery.